Thank you very much, Nigel, and thank you, Matt. It's a pleasure to be here today. I have to, first of all, apologize for my somewhat scruffy look. I was convinced against my own better judgment the day before yesterday to join something called Movember. Does anyone here know about them? So I haven't quite figured out what the connection is between facial hair and prostate cancer, but I'm making a go of it this month, and we'll see what happens. It's really a pleasure to be here for a number of reasons. First of all, Nigel, thank you so much for introducing the concept of culture in this broader sense, because as a medical anthropologist, we tend oftentimes to conflate culture with ethnicity and don't actually attend to the fact that we each participate in various cultural forms throughout our daily lives, and that those cultures do predispose us to look at the world in particular ways. I'm organizing a new Lancet Commission on Culture and Health, and one of the first things we want to debunk is the notion that culture is just about what other people engage in. So thank you for bringing that up. Now, what I want to do is to spend a few minutes. I only have 10, and Nigel is a taskmaster when it comes to finishing within my 10 minutes. So I won't get to say a lot, but I would like to make a few fundamental points. One of them has to do with the work that I do at University College London, in addition to what Nigel's already mentioned, and that is to lead on a new science, medicine, and society initiative. This initiative focuses specifically on trying to generate new projects across disciplines where people otherwise might not necessarily work together. And I bring it up here because there are some fundamental things about trying to have that happen today that are particularly difficult in a climate where we all know that costs are being cut and that new initiatives are plentiful, meaningful initiatives are few, and we all weary from being drawn into yet the next new idea that somebody wants to subject us to. So what we try to do here, and I'll get to my title here in a moment, is to focus on things where nobody owns something, first of all, i.e. where hopefully even people who think they really know a lot about the subject have something to gain by participating. And secondly, what we try to do is we try to alert people to the fact that things that seem peripheral to us today may be central tomorrow. That is to say that interdisciplinarity actually has less to do with getting people from various fields around a table and talking and what's the medical anthropological perspective on culture and innovation, for example, than it does recognizing the fact that these sometimes peripheral things actually do become quite central to a field. And this is especially important, I think, in a climate where we are all subjected to decreasing investment in some of the things that we value most. Why? Because if we have 10 people sitting around a table and some efficiency expert tells us that in a year only 9 of them or 8 of them will be there, what do people do? The first thing they do is they go to their skill sets. They go to their job descriptions. They do a very good job of what they were hired to do, and they think very little about potentially engaging in the other sorts of blue sky things that actually tend to, in the long run, actually create and generate new ideas, innovations, and inventions. So I'm going to say a few words about that now. What's the difference and why should it matter to healthcare? Relevance of medical anthropology, my field. For those of you who don't know, medical anthropologists examine how social habits and cultural attitudes influence health behaviors. For example, why new health delivery systems are taken up or ignored, what allows for new ideas once set in motion to flourish or flounder, or why people are or are not able or willing to modify behaviors. Now, the field does a whole lot more than that, but these are the two that I'm going to focus on. One of my favorite quotes of all time is by the late Oxford philosopher Stuart Hampshire, who in Freedom of the Individual said, "How can you say, you don't have to pardon the gender bias diction, how can you say what a man is trying to do unless you know what he expects to happen?" In other words, if you really have no sense of what actually motivates people to engage in particular behaviors, there's no sense in imposing upon them yet one more innovation that you think might clean the slate or redirect people's behavior or somehow change things. It's important to remember that healthcare innovations, therefore, can only work if people are in a position to change their behavior. This means having, as behavioral modification specialists tell us, having the capability, the opportunity, and the motivation to change. Having the capability, the opportunity, and the motivation, these are things that really interest social scientists And perhaps we can talk a bit about this in the conversation, because not having these things, of course, inhibits us from being able to engage with whatever innovations, good or bad though they may be, are offered to us. One of my favorite quotes of all time: to invent, you need a good imagination and a pile of junk. And I thank Jim Roberts over there, an inventor who has come across the road from his duties as anesthetist across Grayson Road, for conversations that we've had around this question. And I want to bring this quote up, for three reasons, because I think it has all the crucial elements about invention and change in one go. First of all, what does it mean to invent? What constitutes a good imagination? And what on earth does he mean by a pile of junk? Okay. Now, I'm going to spend more time on the first of these. The second one, which is to say, looking at how once we actually understand what an innovation is or an invention, that is to say, looking at how people actually make these happen, is something that I'd like to get to if I have time, but I probably won't, because I want to focus on this.
You have 3 minutes.
3 minutes. It's very important to distinguish between invention and innovation, and patent attorneys do this all the time. I'm bringing it up here because I think we're oftentimes very good at innovation and we're very poor at invention. What is the difference between modifying an existing art and creating a new art? For patent reviewers, there's no difference as long as the thing for which one seeks protection is new, useful, and non-obvious. And it's this third one, non-obvious to any user of the art, that is the most complicated for us. But for the imaginative person, the difference is critical. And this is what I want to bring up, and it's the only point that I'll really get to make until we get to the conversation. Here, innovation means, A, knowing the existing art technology well enough to make the better mousetrap, unfolding the box, as it were, reverse engineering and remaking. In other words, innovators are people who have to think about and know what the state of the art is and somehow modify it. But inventors are very different people, okay? Innovation means convincing investors that the box you build will work better, set a new standard, even make money. It's essentially building a better mousetrap. For Edison, however, the idea of needing a good imagination, all right, in other words, thinking about how Thomas Edison actually worked, he slept maybe 25 times a day. He would take short naps and wake up between his dream time and his waking time. And he would somehow, as most inventors do, superimpose unlikely things, all right? And this is where the pile of junk comes in. It's very hard if you're trying to invent light bulbs and actually change paradigms at the ground level. Like, to know what the outcome is going to be in advance, to be able to go to someone and say, look, we're going to reduce by 10% or 20% the cost of doing such and such. So really the question of how that sort of blue sky thinking gets preserved in the framework of an increasingly restricted working environments that we're all subjected to, I think is perhaps the biggest challenge that we face in terms of coming up with new innovations, new inventions that actually can change the way we behave in fundamental ways.
One.
And I would also like to say, finally, that unless we actually are able to look back and see on the ground what the constraints are that keep people from being able to take these up, I think the chances of our actually making them happen are fairly limited. On the other hand, if we can combine, on the one hand, whatever new technologies are emerging that we find useful and applicable and helpful, with an awareness of how people can be brought to them and actually be able to take advantage of them, and what are the limitations to keep people from taking advantage of them, right? In other words, level the playing field a bit so that people actually have the freedom to try something new, the chances of success, I think, will be much greater. Thank you.
Thank you very much.